So my name is Paul Targonsky. I'm a primary care physician and epidemiologist at Mayo Clinic. And I wanted to talk a little bit about exceptional longevity as it relates to healthy behaviors. And in this case, looking a bit at vaccine receipt and how that interacts with education. So my primary interests really are in aging, and this talk ended up in the infectious disease epi because of the vaccine-related content. But when we talk about successful aging, we talk about it in a variety of different ways. I'm using a relatively simple definition of exceptional longevity that basically says somebody means to age lives to age 90 or older. You'll find definitions that look at the number of comorbidities people have or that they avoid, and there's different values really to looking at a variety of different kinds of definitions, but this is the one we picked. We feel it most represents really frankly what people are going through to get to a certain age, and the comorbidities and other issues are things that to have a significant impact on that, and to remove all of that really limits the results then that we'd find to a very small segment of the population overall. So we built actually a historical cohort of individuals that have moved through Olmsted County, Minnesota, where the Mayo Clinic is located, and we've been able to follow them through looking at their medical records over very long periods of time. In this case, we ended up with over 1,000 folks age 90 or older that we could look at historically, and have collected a variety of different data associated with those folks, including different kinds of comorbidities, different kinds of health behaviors. You can see smoking, alcohol use, vaccine receipt as an example there, and sociodemographic data, as well as some family history and some lifespan history from the families as well. And because of the nature of the records, we can go back and look at that not just at a single point in time, but longitudinally, and so we've picked a number of different time periods to look at that information. This is just kind of a graphical example of how we went about that. We started out with an overall patient population of over 7 million persons that have received care in Olmsted County. We selected amongst that group only those who were at least 90 or older in the year 2000. We picked that year because we wanted to make sure we had really good and as complete as possible data. It takes a long time in processing the medical records electronically and verifying information really to get to really solid information that we can be sure of, so we left ourselves a lag there. And then we looked at folks who died at or near life expectancy and had as residents in Olmsted County, and then those who were alive to age 90 or older. And we went ahead and matched those folks. And the reason we matched them is that we were worried about issues of healthcare access and utilization that could occur over time if we didn't match them by what is called the Mayo Clinic record number. And that's basically a consecutively assigned number to folks as they come into the system. So we tried to match on a record number as well as age and gender as a way of really kind of managing what could have been temporal differences in healthcare access and utilization if we didn't control for that. Ended up with our fine population. And then we were really originally interested in vaccine receipt as an example of a healthy behavior that people undertook. You know, vaccine development and use is considered one of the major public health successes, certainly of the 20th century, and the gains in life expectancy that we've seen certainly correspond to that, and there's a tremendous amount of information out there about direct relationships of vaccine preventing morbidity and mortality for the diseases to which illnesses to which they're directed. But we kept being reminded of kind of the role of education in that, and we see it really with some of the challenges that are faced around the vaccine autism controversies and the way education really keeps working its way back into all-cause mortality, years of potential life lost, the way people approach their health in general, healthcare access, utilization. And there was a really good article in AJPH in August of 2011 that tried to get a feel for what the impact was of variations in education on years of potential life lost. And they were estimating in the year 2000 alone there were an excess 245,000 deaths in the U.S. that were related to education, and that was as significant as things like obesity and smoking and other factors. So this really kind of piqued our interest as we started out thinking a lot more typically in a biomedical model about comorbidities and really tried to broaden our perspective a little. We took this as a nested case control within the historical cohort of these people kind of moving over time, and so because we matched, we used conditional logistic regression. And then we looked at vaccine status at life expectancy with achievement of exceptional longevity. And this is just an example of the some of the cohort characteristics. So years of available healthcare data on average, about 46 years of healthcare data for folks by the time they were age 65, and we could take that back to between 2 and 69 years. So we had people that were obviously beyond age 65 when we were doing some of the matching. Total number of healthcare episodes on average, about 296 healthcare episodes over time, about 10 a year on average. Now, of course, you can imagine as people are approaching death, you know, the number of healthcare episodes is going up tremendously. So there's a potential for skewing, but we looked at time periods at 0, 1, 10, and 30 years prior to death for the folks that didn't make it to age 90. And then we found a variety of things. This is just to show that we found some things that were related to comorbidities. So as you might expect, myocardial infarction, stroke, TIA, diabetes, coronary artery disease, all were protective against reaching age 90. So that kind of makes sense. You know, if you have those things, the odds of getting to age 90 are lower. One of the things that we found quite fascinating, actually, was if you look at proximal or intermediate phenotypes that are associated with these kinds of conditions like BMI, and you start putting those into the models, you decrease the overall impact of these conditions, or in some cases actually remove them from the model. So we were thinking about education that way as well. And then when we went ahead and looked at vaccine receipt, you can see in the graph here, tried to present the percent receipt of different kinds of vaccinations, and that was looking at folks that had received those 10 years prior to achieving life expectancy. So keeping up with tetanus boosters, getting the influenza vaccine, polio vaccine, typhoid, just because it was available, we threw it in there. And then just to show some of the other data, mother's age, father's age, and then education overall. And what you can see is that tetanus, influenza, polio, seem to be associated with increased odds, but tetanus influenza, statistically insignificant increase in odds of getting to age 90 or older. The polio vaccine, on the other hand, it is statistically significant in terms of conferring a proportional benefit to your overall odds of getting to age 90 or older. And then when we actually began to combine those in some interactive models, we found that there was a significant interaction between polio and education that augmented the effect for both of those variables separately. Education alone, for each year of education that you have, it increased your odds of getting to age 90 or older by 7%. So what does this mean? You know, the polio vaccine, of course, was developed in the 50s. It was applied in the 60s. It was generally directed very much towards kids. I'll go back and you can see the proportion of folks that received in the case group, those living to age 90 or older versus the control group, those dying at life expectancy. You know, it was not incredibly high, but the vaccine had been made available to folks through the various immunization strategies. Now people don't feel that it's even worth vaccinating adults unless it's very specific conditions where they're going to have exposures. So at the time, the way we were thinking about this is what factors would influence folks to want to receive that vaccine or to receive that vaccine, and how could there be an association with education? So I put together this kind of very crude visual representation of how some of these things might fit together. And it's really an attempt to move a little bit further away from some of the traditional kind of biomedical models where we talk about comorbidities and things, and start to think more into that cluster in the lower left-hand corner where we're talking about how education may influence folks' health selecting and health managing behaviors. And when we're in an era now, certainly of increasing prevalence of chronic diseases and longer lifespans, this is something that is really important. The bad news is I don't have the answer, but what I'm hoping to do is jog people to begin to think a little bit more globally about how these things may or may not interrelate. And I think there's kind of a neat potential similar example that we're seeing historically right now with vaccine receipt and education and thinking about health promoting behaviors, and that's actually with the human papillomavirus vaccine, which to me I thought in some ways was the first sexist vaccine brought out by and endorsed by the medical industry and the healthcare profession by directing it only at women, clearly when if you are vaccinating men as well, you can derive population benefits from that. Now we're seeing that the strategies are changing, which I think is fantastic. But how would it be that someone would think about receiving a vaccine, and how can that then relate to somebody getting to be age 90 or older when you're talking about, in this case, polio, as the vaccine example, really not having a tremendous impact overall on mortality in adults. And so our thoughts is that it was simply reflecting a type of proactive behavior that was reflected in other behaviors that people are undertaking in order to maintain and improve their health. So I think it's like this is kind of a really neat example of looking at how some of these things interact and then beginning to think more broadly of where we can apply to better understand the attributable benefit or attributable risk associated with different kinds of socio-demographic variables and health-promoting behaviors. Vaccine receipt in this case seems to be an example of a healthy behavior that's associated with odds of reaching longer lifespans. The years of education that we're seeing, the benefits associated with education certainly are consistent. And we'd like to think and certainly explore further how healthy behaviors are mediated by education and other kinds of factors. Now, that being said, you know, vaccine status at the time of life expectancy 10 years prior doesn't necessarily reflect long-term or lifelong behaviors, and there's certainly a lot of life course information that we have to think about as we look at these kinds of associations. In this case, we haven't completely adjusted for comorbidity and other factors, so we have things like, you know, the medical conditions that I've shown you, and BMI and other proximal factors that eventually have to get put into the models in a thoughtful way, so we can keep them as mutually exclusive as possible and still retain some of the associations and interactions. And really the question is vaccine receipt even, or some of these other things like BMI, just epiphenomena for other kinds of healthy behaviors and actions? And you know, where can we actually make our highest bang for the buck interventions? Do we try to address treating people after heart attacks versus preventing heart attacks versus lowering BMI versus improving education so that people have higher levels of self-efficacy to manage that on their own versus using drugs? And that's really kind of what we're trying to get to at the end of the day, to me, with these kinds of analysis. And then this is Sydney Harris. He says, I think you should be more explicit here in step two, when he's pointing to the middle of the blackboard. It says, then a miracle occurs. And I find like the vast majority of my work is like this. The other one that he has that's fantastic is he says to the audience during a presentation, there's somebody standing up speaking with an audience, and the presenter says, please keep in mind that like everyone else, I use only 10% of my brain, and I'd like you to keep that in mind for me too. So thank you very much, and I also want to make sure I thank my team, a variety of people across a variety of disciplines that work very hard on this work as well. So thank you.